high volume versus doing regen ag, where it's just like you're not fighting nature, you're working with nature to get to the results that you're looking for. Right. Like, why does that not, like, just common sense? Like, why does that, like, because it's no different than setting up a wind or like a hydroelectric dam or whatever on a, like, a small little river, right, to provide power for your home.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that.
Like everything else, I think it's largely skewed by bad financial incentives.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, farming in the United States of America is not just this thing where guys go out and they farm. It's heavily affected by government subsidies, by government regulation. You know, I have some family members that farm, and they a lot of what they do is based upon what the government's kind of pushing them to do for the most part.
And the tragedy of that is all of that surplus, all of that stuff that's, you know, not produced by the low cost producers, not produced in a, you know, best return on investment kind of sound decision making, sustainable system. All of that excess gets dumped in Africa, and so it kills the price for our farmers who are struggling to do it well and all that kind of thing, and they don't have access to subsidies, and it's a livelihood, and then, you know, this free stuff we're competing with free. So there's, you know, boatloads of free corn show up every season and get distributed by the aid organizations or the government or whoever. And the farmers are like, thanks, guys. You know, how am I going to sell my stuff now? So it's crazy. So effectively.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, it, you know, a lot of those decision chains are being made by big agri and big pharma because they all kind of work in cahoots, so to speak.
For sure.
And then also the processing and distribution has also been somewhat captured. So this is starting to, from my understanding, is starting to affect American ranchers now, where what's happening is that the big meat processors who a lot of these guys are in cahoots with some way or owned by folks who would like to see the U.S. beef industry largely disappear.
Yeah.
You know. Like one of these guys, I think he owns like some synthetic meat company, like Almost Meat, whatever the hell it's called.
Yeah. Almost Meat.
Yeah. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And then you've got like these WEF guys who are all like, yeah, live in the pods and eat the bugs. We're going to feed you guys bugs for the next, you know, however long of your lives.
Cause all and, of that sounds desirable.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. Right. So what they're doing is they're importing apparently super cheap beef out of Argentina into the United States of America, which is tanking the beef prices at the store, which is putting all the small ranchers out of business.
Right.
So the big ranchers or the big agri can come in and buy up all their land.
Yeah, that's it. So Alan Savory, you know, the kind of guy, the founder, he's kind of the guy that's credited with coming up with mob grazing or strip grazing, you know, that kind of thing. And mimicking the bison herds that, you know, moved about by the millions and kind of stomped down everything and dropped, you know, they dunged and ate and stomped down just tracts of land and went through as they migrated. And they would never return to the same meadow, the same field for another 12 months. And so that system basically of being able to just high intensity grazing, moving them on. So 500 cows per acre, you know, most people talk about.
Holy crap.
Yeah, I mean, it's like shoulder to shoulder. They're packed in there. And everybody just thought he was absolutely crazy. And then they started watching it and, whoa, okay, he's now growing four times the amount of grass as a traditional setup. And so it now it's kind of seeing is believing, you know. And yeah, so I've actually been to his ranch out in sort of western Zimbabwe. And it's like huge, over 6,000 hectares. And just incredible 700 head of cattle that just move like this.
So what did you call that? Strip grazing.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different names.
There is a ranch here doing that. There is a guy, I saw a picture of it. There's a guy, are you guys familiar with Untapped Growth? He's on Twitter.
Yeah.
Okay. So this guy, I saw a picture he posted the other day where he's like, got this entire thing, the strip grazing thing going on. Brilliant. And they're doing it.
Yeah. So cool. There's a great show. If you just check out, so the, I think the YouTube kind of, the social media stuff is, Carbon Cowboys. And so they're coming, you know, they sort of come at it from a sort of a climate change kind of an angle, all that sort of thing. But if you can get through all that, you know, just the system that these guys are using. So they've done a documentary with five pairs of farmers, so five different states, two neighbors, one doing regen, one doing conventional, and they've assessed everything from carbon to calving, you know, number of young to liters of milk to, you know, dollars on fertilizer and pesticides, or, you know, all across the board. And they've compared these neighbors, one conservation, one regen, and just seeing the differences. And it's just mind blowing. I mean, you watch that documentary and you, you know, walk away from there saying, well, it's pretty simple.
You ought to give us a link to that documentary. We'll put it up in our notes and stuff. Okay. When we put this out on social media, we'll also link that up so people can watch it. I'm sure people will be interested in seeing that.
Yeah. Cool.
So okay. Like, how do they reach like the 500 cattle per acre? Is it they do it in waves? Like they push them through like in a line or in a group essentially, and then have the next group come through and then the next group come through? Or
So basically you'll decide. So it's based on the quality of the grazing. So when you've got really good grass, and so like now, I mean, I'm just looking out here in Georgia at the moment, it's green, everything's lush, the grass is, you know, 3 feet high. You would just push them in there and put a line of electric wire around on that acre, push 500 cows in there. And then you kind of tape off the next acre. And after one day, some guys move multiple times a day based on, you know, you just look at the quality of, once the grass has kind of been browsed down to a certain level, you just open up the next section and the cows basically just run into the next sort of available pasture. And you just keep moving them like that. You just keep opening up into a new section. And they just go like that. And then you never return them back to the same piece of ground for, you know, whatever. Ideally, I mean, ultimately, if you can do it every year, if you can do a 12-month rotation, you just carve your whole farm up into 365 plots. So if you have 365 acres, 500 head, you just move them every day. And then that ground has a chance to absorb all the nitrogen from the dropping. It has a chance to regenerate. So instead of the cows just browsing out and killing the sweet grasses, they're forced to eat everything. And so they go in there, they just mow it down, and then they move. So they don't have a chance to kill any of the grasses. You know, they eat everything equally, and then everything comes back in the next 12 months. So you just have this incredible perpetual system. I'm just typing now. So carbon cowboys.
And you would have had all the cow manure fertilizing the ground.
Exactly.
The entire time they're there.
That's right. So these guys are now saving up to $100,000 worth of fertilizer that they would have had to put on that grass to get the same amount of food.
Holy crap.
And that's the big thing. What is it? Who's the guy from Top Gear that started his own show on farming up there in the UK?
Yes. I know.
I'm not going to get it. at any rate, it's one of those shows where he's obviously terrible at farming, but
yeah.
The beautiful thing and the really smart angle that he's taking is he's basically showing a lot of this capability. And there was one, I think it was in season three, and that's what we do up here in North Georgia. We watch farming shows. It's the most, you know, 40-year-old thing to do in the world. But one of the shows, he had a guy come out and talk about regenerative farming, and it was all about money in versus yield at that point. Yeah, and yeah. You know, the amount that you save on the fertilizers, the pesticides, all that, you know,
water, fuel.
Yeah. Right. And then marrying the right kind of crops together that are, you know, going to bring nitrogen into the field at the same time as others are taking it out. And you're just like, man, this is very smart. And you're not going to get the best harvest, you know, per pound, but you're going to spend less money. And that's what it's all about at the end.
At the end of the day, that's what it's all about, you know? Yeah. So I've actually just come to, when was it, two weeks ago, in Cape Town, South Africa, was the World Congress on Conservation Agriculture. And we had farmer after farmer after farmer, predominantly South African commercial farmers, but a number of, I mean, we had guys from Brazil, South America, you know, all over the world. There was a guy there from sort of the Netherlands, German guys, all over the world, sharing their stories and documenting. And the guys have, you know, kind of proven it. So just across all these different sort of systems. And it's amazing. It is the way.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
This is the way.
I just love all the different groups that are finding each other, especially in this space. And I mean, Matt, you know, I guess I shouldn't be surprised to find that you're already a Bitcoiner if you're hanging out with Matt and everything. But, you know, to have Bitcoiners in this space, especially with, you know, regenerational farming and what you've done, which I can't wait to introduce our crowd to. I think you guys are going to be absolutely amazed. But should we get on with this thing since we have a quorum?
Yeah, let's do it.
Ladies and gents, we got Matthew Mbanga. Am I saying that right? Mbanga?
Mbanga.
Okay.
Yeah.
We got Matthew Mbanga with us tonight. I think you guys are going to learn a ton right now. Hold on your butts. Bitcoin Veterans is coming at you. Welcome to Bitcoin Veterans, everybody. I'm Shane Hazel. I've got Mike Hobart with me and Alex Stanzik. The other guys are off tonight. Our guest tonight is going to be Matthew Mbanga. And I'm going to swear.
That's fine. Mess
up. Mbanga. We've got a hell of a show for you guys on regenerational farming. We've got some amazing stories that he's going to tell us tonight. And then I think it's going to tie in nicely to a lot of the stuff that's going around the world with farmers. And I mean, in what we're experiencing in terms of, I think, an attack on our food supply and everything else, and just bad incentive structure. But this is Bitcoin Veterans. We are here to put you back on the mission, to provide you passion in this idea of liberty, this American dream that we've always learned and talked about. It's something that we have found so much privilege in bringing to our fellow vets. There's 16 million plus vets out there right now, and introducing them to a real mission that is focused on everything that we were told about as kids, whether it's, you know, liberty, it's sovereignty, it is the self-independence that we are striving for. This is the place for you. How does Bitcoin get you there? Stick around and find out. This is so multifaceted. There are so many rabbit holes. The learning is just begun. We got to pay some bills first and foremost. Alex Stanzik, you want to hit it after we see the first video?
Sure. Let's do it. Let's talk about Silent.
Silent.
All right, so have you ever considered how much information is stored on your phone? Personal data, bank accounts, access to two-factor authentication. All the apps that you've got on your phone, for the most part, are providing data that tells a story about you. That's why we are teaming up with SLNT, also known as Silent. SLNT offers an efficient and easy solution to protect your location and personal data. Their Faraday products block all incoming and outgoing signals, so nobody can get their hands on your information. Simply place your device inside, close the sleeve. That's it. You're off the grid, untrackable, and safe from unauthorized access. Hardware wallets are also a mission-critical form of gear. If you're a Bitcoiner, it's crucial to keep them safe from hackers and events like EMPs and solar flares. SLNT's Faraday bags provide an extra layer of protection for your Bitcoin. Go check them out at slnt.com/BTCVets to save 15%, plus free shipping and qualifying orders. Again, slnt.com/BTCVets for 15% off. Our other sponsor is Black Sheep Ammunition. These guys really hooked us up for our range day in Nashville. They basically gave us 6,000 rounds of ammunition to run our range day. And they're the best. They're a veteran-owned company manufacturing American-made goods for dedicated sportsmen and those ready to get ready to defend. Their motto says, our mission is to supply every freedom-loving American with enough firepower to get the job done twice.
Yeah, I'm going to say it every show, because if he's worth one, he's worth two, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. Hey,
spend a couple bucks on that guy. Show him your love.
Yeah, what a bunch of great guys, man. Got to tell you, I'm very impressed with what they gave us. And, you know, everything that we got to do with those veterans out on the range a couple weeks ago, unreal. And thanks to them, we got to do maybe a little bit of extra training. And everybody who's training that day loves firing more rounds than not. So it was awesome. Anyway, our guest tonight, Matthew Mbanga. He is first of all, he's a doctor. I should say Dr. Matthew, by the way. Born and raised in Zimbabwe, he attended the university here in Texas. He returned to Zimbabwe to serve his countrymen to transform their impoverished nation. He began running leadership camps and eventually became the CEO of an organization that reaches sustainable agriculture to small-scale farmers. It goes well beyond this. Matt trained about 1.8 million, is that correct? 1.8 million farmers, and helped secure the Zimbabwe food crop and distributed that to over 9 million people. So it was the first time Zimbabwe had been, independent in terms of their own crops in over 20 years. And absolutely huge accomplishment. He's a hell of a charisma guy. I think you guys are going to love the show. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thank you so much. So before we go any further, I just want to say that all of that was as part of a team. I had the privilege of leading an incredible team, an incredible group of people. And so I'd love to take the credit for that, but can't take the credit without some incredible people who did some amazing work. Thank you. Yeah, it was a real highlight for me to be part of that.
So and humble as well. So but before we got started, we've been talking about regeneration in farming, and maybe we could give a quick recap to some of the things that you're seeing out there on why this is important and how it's working and where it's working.
Yeah, look, so in terms of the whole farming piece for us in Zimbabwe, just was kind of not even a choice. Even for me, it was just a necessity. We live in a country where we've been through a tremendous amount of stuff. I don't know how much you know about kind of the history of Zimbabwe. Formerly Rhodesia, became independent through a war in 1980, so a year of my birth. My parents were both journalists, and so not involved in the war, but documenting and seeing an incredible amount of stuff. Fighting for freedom of expression, fighting for freedom, and as journalists to be able to just tell the truth and share all of that. So the country is free, breaks through, incredible, wonderful, this brand new nation. I'm born as a mixed race kid in this newly independent country. Wow, it's utopia. And my dad's, running the national news agency. And it was just a wonderful sort of time. But then the president, so Robert Mugabe, who became the president in 1980, 15 years later, he's still the president. 20 years later, he's still the president. 30 years later, he's still the president. And everybody was, had this kind of euphoria, this first black president in Zimbabwe, and, nationalization. Great. Oh, we trust you guys. And the government sort of rode the wave of, having this trust and love of everybody for 30 years. And then power did what power does, but, power corrupts. And so this wonderful liberation hero leader basically becomes drunk on power and just tries to just remain, maintain his grip on power. And so single party state for those still, look, it's 44 years now, but at that stage, he was losing his grip and people were sort of seeing cracks and wanting, so he actually nationalized all the farmland, just took all the farms, all the productive commercial farms in the country. And under the guise of redistribution, he was going to redistribute them to landless poor. And on the face of that, you can't argue with that. Wow, that's okay. Yeah, sure. What a great guy. That's a great idea. But in reality, they were redistributed to those that were connected to the inner circle and kind of political elites, people with no training in farming, no interest in farming. And so our economy just collapsed as an agriculturally backed economy. Economy collapsed, we're unable to feed ourselves. And so from about 2000 until about 2020, Zimbabwe unable to feed itself, insecure, you know, food wise. On the top of that, shifting season. So our rain comes now exactly a month late. And so you don't farm, I don't know if you know how much you guys know about growing corn or whatever, but it's very reliant on the heat units of the sun. So your yield is very predictable based on the time that you plant. So the longest day of the year is the 21st of December every year. And so if you plant your maize crop in our part of the world, in the Southern Hemisphere, you must plant your corn or your maize by the 25th of November in order for it to be at sort of 3 feet tall, the optimal growth phase in a corn plant, in time for the longest day of the year, so that it can take advantage of the maximum heat units of the season, of the year, and then it will get its optimal growth and optimal yield. So basically, without rain, we have 99% of our farmers, 99% of our agriculture is rain-fed agriculture. So we don't have the big commercial farms, we don't have the pivots, we don't have the irrigation. And so if we don't have the rainfall at the right time, we're in big trouble. So our national average maize yield for small-scale farmers by 2019 was down to less than a ton per hectare. Just to kind of put that in perspective, I think here in the United States, it's around 12 tons per hectare. So we were less than one ton per hectare and able to feed it ourselves. So we partnered with the government and organization I was working for at that stage. We partnered with the government and trained 1.8 million small-scale farmers to do things on time at a high standard without wastage and with joy. And that's kind of the management system that was developed by the founder of that organization, a guy called Brian Aldreeve, incredible guy, my mentor to this day. I'm still working with him. And that was his management system. And he taught people to plant on time and to do things at a high standard, to not waste, because the low-cost producer wins the day. And that's across any business. You know, you apply those four simple standards of management on time, at a high standard, without wastage, and with joy. He said, you know, you've got to do things with joy. And then that joy becomes your work ethic. And basically, if you do those things, invariably in the end, you will make a profit. And so this simple management system was trained by our team of about 50 folk across the country to 1.8 million people. Now, 60% of that was via radio, TV, print media that never actually attended a physical training conducted by our team. There was, you know, multimedia. And that was a statistic that I heard from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization that did an independent assessment on the season that raised the national average yield for these 1.8 million households to 5.8 tons per hectare, from less than a ton to 5.8 tons. So almost, you know, sixfold increase in productivity and food security, and, you know, brought us out of this 20-year kind of dearth of food sovereignty. So just an incredible sort of journey. I was then, you know, invited to Rome to the General Assembly of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization to receive this award on behalf of the organization for feeding 9 million people in the midst of COVID. So that was 2020/2021 was the season. So an incredible sort of ride. But people realized that actually farming this way was an empirical. We were no longer able to just do things the way that we'd done all along. We've lost so much topsoil. We are locked into a cycle of diminishing returns. You know, the more fertilizer you put in, the more you have to put in. And, you know, basically the ground is so sterile and dead and has no natural fertility that you've got to put more fertilizer on every single year, and your yields just go down and down and down. And it's crazy. It's just a zero sum game. But who's winning, you know, in that game? Big farm, big fertilizer companies, you know, big ag companies. That the guys that are selling you the seed every season, those hybrid seeds that, you know, you got to buy the seed. And then if you retain some of your harvest and try to plant that the next season, it's like a mule. It doesn't work the next season. So you got to go back and buy another round of seed. When open pollinated variety or heirloom seeds, exist and have existed since time immemorial. I mean, and if farmers had those seeds, yes, the yield is lower, but guess what? They're free. And so again, zero, the low cost producer wins the day. So if you don't have to buy your seed every season, you're starting out with zero. It's just your own labor to put that seed in. And then the harvest is 100% profit. And if you do it organically, you can build your fertilizer, build your compost pile, use your cattle manure, that kind of thing, get the livestock into the system, and you're away. And so it's a completely perpetual system, a cycle of perpetual productivity, where you don't have to buy seed, you don't have to buy fertilizer, you're off the grid, you're away, and you can feed your family. And 1.8 million households proved that, discovered that, lived that just a few years ago, 3 years ago in Zimbabwe.
Well, Doc, if you don't like, I don't know, you guys may not have this information, but I'm just curious, because like my natural train of thought is to like doing things the more natural way, which is the regenerative agriculture way. Yes, sir. Makes me want to believe that like, while you stated like the yield may go down as far as the volume, I would think that the nutrient density of that yield goes up, right? Is that true? Have you guys seen that?
100%, Mike, you nailed it. And that's exactly it. So, you know, now in Zimbabwe, in Africa, we don't see the diseases of deficiency. There's no, you know, in Zimbabwe, this is where we're experiencing right now, the worst drought in 40 years. So it's dire. Yeah, there's not enough food and all that sort of thing. But people are not dying of starvation. So more people are dying in Zimbabwe from diseases like kidney failure and diabetes and kind of sort of the diseases of excess, not the diseases of deficiency or deficit.
And so which I don't mean to interrupt you, which is important for people to understand that like those diseases are still diseases of malnutrition.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And it's because we're being pumped full of kind of these empty calories. We're being pumped full of this white flour, you know, corn that is not healthy. It's poor nutrition. And so it'll keep you alive, you know, but it's not healthy. It's a problem. So kind of these, you know, type 2 diabetes is this new kind of thing that's a massive spike in Zimbabwe. My dad has type 2 diabetes because of poor nutrition, poor diet, living in Zimbabwe. And this is one of my big things at the moment that I'm working on in Zambia, actually, because Zambia is even worse than Zimbabwe in terms of malnutrition for young people. So, you know, for children under the age of 7, if you don't get around, you know, for a square diet, you don't get proper nutrition, you have brain sort of problems, you have learning disabilities that are lifelong from poor nutrition. And so 26% of the children in Zimbabwe suffer from that. 36% of the children in Zambia suffer from that. Poor nutrition leading to disability, you know, poor mental faculty that they will never recover from. It doesn't matter if they suddenly get a healthy diet and whatever after the age of 10, they'll never catch up. They'll never recover from those learning disabilities. And so for me, that's just an absolute tragedy. And so I'm trying to do things like introducing different foods like chia, you know, chia with the omega sort of acids in there, just incredibly healthy. It's brain food. It's only available in sort of seafood. And Zimbabwe, Zambia, you know, we're landlocked. So these kids are not getting access to those nutrients. And so even if we did give them a whole bunch of corn and whatever, that's not the nutrition that they need. And so corn syrup and all the things that the aid agencies are just pumping into these kids, it's not what they need. And so we've got to get healthy nutrition, better nutrition, proper nutrition, protein. You know, there's no reason why we can't grow enough protein with this regenerative agriculture, introducing your goats and your sheep and your cattle and chickens into the system. So it's a 5M system for me. It's multiple species. So you can't just have corn. You got to have, you know, a bunch of different sort of things. That's good for the drought and all those things as well. If one crop fails, another crop will do well. You got to have minimal soil disturbance, so no plowing, maximum soil cover, so that's mulch, management, so that management system I spoke about, high management. Yield is directly proportional to standards. If you have high standards, you will have a high yield. And then the final M is movement of mammals. You got to get animals back into the system and have them move around. You know, the cows follow the pigs, the chickens follow the cows, that whole sort of system in there. And that's life. You're bringing all the organic nutrients back into your system that nature was designed to be able to do. And then it's a sustainable thing.
Can I back up for 1 second? I caught four of those, but you said there were five. So I caught multiple species, minimal disturbance. In other words, we're not plowing. Thank you. Max cover, which means mulch, et cetera. And then movement of mammals. What was the other one that I missed?
The other one was management.
Okay.
So high management. Yeah. A lot of people kind of just think that, it's the off season, there's no rain or whatever. So time to go and drink beer, and which, I'm not against that, but farming is a business. And if you want to be profitable, then it's a 12 month of the year commitment.
Did you go to school for this, Doc? Is this what you came to the US to study under, or what'd you go to school for?
So I went to school for communication. My parents are journalists. My dad started the first independent, so non-government owned daily newspaper in Zimbabwe back in the 90s. And for his efforts, that paper was bombed and the title was banned. So that's why I came to school over here, because it wasn't safe at home. And so my sister and I both went to school in Texas. And so we both did communications as our undergrad, basically thinking, it's the family business kind of thing. We'll do that. And then while I was at school in Texas, my grandfather, so my mom's dad, so white grandfather on our family farm, during the land kind of redistribution takeovers thing, government sponsored program, my grandfather was stabbed 17 times in our farmhouse. And lived. And wow. So I remember just thinking, I'm done. I've been in Texas for 5 years. I'm like, I will never go back to Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is finished. And so my grandparents left. They went to the UK, settled in the UK. My parents fled. My dad had been arrested and was basically being harassed by the government because of his newspaper, which was the Daily News. And the tagline was telling it like it is. So basically exposing government corruption and government kind of mismanagement. And of course, they didn't like that. So they left the country, flew to the UK. And actually when they landed in London, the lady kind of looks at my dad's passport and says, "Oh, Wolf Mbanga." And he says, "Yes." And she turns around and nods at these two plainclothes guys. And they come around and they say, "Mr. Mbanga, please come with us." And he's like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, is everything okay?" And they said, "Yes, sir. We know who you are. We please just come with us. We want to talk to you." So he goes into a back office. They say, "Mr. Mbanga, we know about the newspaper. We know about everything that's been happening in Zimbabwe, and we know that you're here in the UK to come and set up another newspaper and continue to This was all secret. This was all private that my parents had been discussing. Oh, this is the plan. We'll leave Zim. We'll go to England. We can have safe haven there. We can start our newspaper there and continue to tell the truth and get the story out." And and so these guys knew everything. So somebody was listening. Anyway, so they go and he says, "When you go down to Southampton, where your wife's parents live, and you find a house, please call this guy, special agent so and so. And he, they'll come and look and make sure that you're okay." So they go down there, they rent a house, call this guy. He comes with a team of detectives. They walk around the house, drawing kind of exits and entrances and windows and just kind of checking the whole place out. And then give my dad a panic button. And he says, "If you see anything untoward, just push the button and we'll send an unmarked police car past your residence every day just to check on you. We don't want Mr. Mugabe to do anything silly while you're on British soil. So welcome to the UK. Have a, all the best," sort of thing.
That's actually kind of interesting. It sounded like they were they're violating your privacy for one, but
yes,
they still provided security. So, it's a negative with a positive outcome, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, amazing. And then just to tell another quick story about that kind of thing while we're here. So during that sort of time, I then, and I'll tell this, I'll save the main sort of story for story time, but I go back to Zimbabwe not long after that. And basically my dad prints a story on one of the generals, one of the main kind of bad dudes kind of thing. And the guy calls my dad on his phone in the UK and says, take down the story. It's damaging my reputation, you know, repeal the story. And my dad says, we know the story's true. You know, I'm not taking it down. And so the guy says, okay, call Harari in 1 hour and see what I've done. So this guy was legendary, like bad dude from the war sort of times. I mean, anyway, so I'm the only member of my family at that stage in Harare. So my dad obviously like freaks out, like calls me, hey, where are you? And I was just started dating my wife at that stage. And I was like, oh, dad, I've just, you know, just dropped off this beautiful girl, man. Oh, she's the one, dad, she's the one. And he's like, yeah, yeah, okay, okay. Listen, get home as fast as you can and I'll call you back, you know. So I go home, he says, lock, make sure everything's locked up and then I'll call you in 15 minutes. So get home, he calls back and I'm like, you know, what's up? And he says, okay, this is what's happened. So listen, go to the British Embassy at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. Here's the name of the lady that you need to speak to. She'll give you a British visa. You jump on the lunchtime flight. You're coming over here. We've got to get you out. You're in danger, you know. So I was like freaking out. Okay. So of course that night, you know, don't sleep. I know who the guy is. And I'm just like, oh man, this is not good. So next morning, you know, sunrise, shoot into town, go there, try and get into the embassy and get upstairs. Finally, you know, talk my way in past the guards and everything, get upstairs and ask for this lady. And the guy goes to the back, comes back. She says, oh, she doesn't know anything about you. Is this about a visa? And I said, yes, it's about a visa. Oh, sorry. See this line? There's a line of people like wrapping around the building on the street. You need to go join that line. I was like, man, I'm going to get like cut down in the street. Like, this is not good. So they kicked me out and I was like, call my dad. And so they had taken my phone away. So they give me my phone back at the gate. I call my dad. Hey, listen, she doesn't know anything about me. You know, what's the deal? And, he says, oh, wait. And I'll, you know, just try again in 15 minutes. I was like, these guys are not going to let me in. So 15 minutes later, I try again. I go back to the guards at the gate and I'm like, please, I need to see this lady. Please let me in. This is my name. Take my passport. And while I'm busy trying to convince the guard to let me back in, this lady comes and says, are you Matthew? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, oh, let him in. Come quickly. Sorry, I hadn't got the email from the Home Office. Come in. Go inside, rush upstairs. She prints the visa, slaps through my passport. She says, go. You got to get to the airport now. You're on the lunchtime flight to London, go. And so jumped on, got out of there, flew to the UK. I was in the UK for about 3 months and just kind of just chilling, just hiding out, you know, just with my parents, just staying away from Zim. And during that time, this general.
How old were you when this was happening?
So at that stage, I was 26.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. So during that 3 months while I'm in the UK, the general dies in a mysterious house fire in Zimbabwe. And so my dad's like, okay, it's over. You're safe. You can go back home. So I went back home, carried on, running the distribution for their newspaper.
It was a gas explosion.
Yeah. Yeah. Burnt beyond recognition. So yeah. Good. Yeah. Crazy. Wow. Yeah. And that's how, you know, the government sort of operated in those days. And I don't know, still does, but
crazy. That's incredible.
Man, we went from regenerational farming to, you know, this life.
Intel community, like there was no like transition. It's just
the life,
like,
of dang. The life of secret agent Matthew Mbanga. Okay, I'm curious. Without doxing the guy's last name, you're at our buddy Matt's house, I believe, over there in Georgia. Is that right? So that's Matt, right, is a member of Bitcoin Veterans. He's got that Citadel out there. By the way, he's graciously and kindly invited us to come out there and do a Bitcoin Veterans thing at some point.
Very cool.
Which we're gonna do.
Yeah,
it's a great. I'm super curious if you're if Matt and you guys are, you're okay telling the story. How do you know him?
So I met Matt at a Boy Scout retreat. So his son was on this camp, and it was being run at the ranch of a guy that I played rugby with in college in Texas. And so I happened to be out from Zim helping, you know, facilitate this camp. That's my passion, by the way. That's kind of what I do, is run these kind of retreats, camps, whatever, expeditions for young men and talk about authentic masculinity and help young men.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
My man, you and I are two peas from the same pod. I'm all about that too.
Brilliant. Okay. Amazing. Fantastic. So, yeah. Right. So we're busy doing that. And one of the things was a mile swim. And so, you know, all the kids are doing it and none of the other dads were kind of, you know, into it, but I was like, I'll do a mile swim. And Matt, of course, you know, ex-Navy SEAL, was like, let's go. So him and I kind of casually sort of walk into this kind of river, this big swimming pond. And, you know, we're like, oh, yeah, no, I'll just do it for fun. I mean, I'm not, you know, competitive. I'm just, you know, I'll just swim with the kids. And, you know, we're both kind of like just, but, you know, like 100 feet into it, we're both like, like going crazy. And I was like trying to act like I wasn't trying to, but, you know, same thing. Anyway, so we race this mile swim and get out at the end and just hug each other. You know, we just met literally the day before. And we do this thing and it was great. We finished like this and we get up and we just start hugging each other and just like, hey man, that was awesome. You know, who are you kind of thing. And so, yeah, we kind of became fast friends from there. That was 2019. I then invited him and his son to come on one of the camps that I run in Zimbabwe. And so they came in January, 2020 and that just kind of sealed it. You know, he loved it. He was like, wow, this is so cool. You know, it's great what we can do in the States, but what you can do out here in Africa, this is crazy. We would never be able to get to do this with our kids. And this is what young men need. You know, so we were basically talking to, we had 120 12-year-old boys on that initial one. And it was, we did man school. We told them, you know, this is what it means to be a man. And we had 4 days of rolling around in the mud every day, sleeping in the bush, no showers, no toothbrushing, no, you know, problem solving, playing games, just having a ball. And he said, hey, you know, I love this. Can I come back? And I said, hey, there's one with 17-year-olds, which is, you know, next level, because obviously they're that much older. You can talk to them about a whole bunch more stuff. So he came back and did that sort of 2 years later. And then I've now here with him, we're going to run a couple this year. So one for men, actually. This one's, we're not doing any teenager ones now. But we're going to do one together in Junction, Texas, where we met, and with men. So just about 15, 16 men. Same sort of thing, because we want to be tested, you know. So we're going to do an adventure race. We're going to do a couple of sort of talks and just discuss the usual, you know, fighting for the hearts of your wife, fighting for the hearts of your kids, the stuff that matters.
I love it.
God, we should dive into this a little bit. I mean, why not? I mean, fighting for the hearts of your wife and your kids. You want to talk about that a little bit? Because I think, I mean, in this setting, since we're already here, we're already, you know, diving down this, you know, this path is, I think this is one of those things that goes missed a lot. I had a great dinner with one of my buddies from my old platoon just this last Friday night, and he's had a girlfriend for quite a while off and on, and asked me, you know, hey man, like, what's the secret? You know, both of them asked me, what's the secret to, you know, sticking around and making all this kind of stuff work? I'd be very curious as to get your take on this whole thing. How long have you been married first?
So 16 years now.
All right, on. Okay. And kids?
Yeah, 4 kids.
Wow, yeah. Man. Okay. So
yeah, 2 girls, you're 2 boys.
You're doing something right there. tell us a little bit about fighting for the heart of your wife and kids.
Yeah, no. So thank you. Thank you for the privilege of being able to speak about that. That's what it's all about. You know, I think for guys, we long to have a battle to fight. And this is actually, I'll borrow from John Eldridge's kind of words, because it's so simple and so true. So a battle to fight, an adventure to live, and a beauty to fight for. You know, that's the heart of a man. That's what I was doing when I was a 12-year-old kid, covering myself in mud, running around in the bush and kind of, you know, fighting. I was living this dream, believing that I was the hero, But what's the point of being the hero unless you can come through on behalf of a beauty and ransom her and you know, save the day? And so I think that that's who we are. At the end of the day, that's what we're made for. And whether we are kind of aware of that the whole time or not, that's, if you go back and tell your stories, what you used to do at the age of 7, at 14, at 21, at 28, at 35, you know, you just remember those stories. That's who you are. Fundamentally, as warriors, we want to be the hero. We want to come through. We want to win the day. We want to ride to the sunset with our beauty. And so I think the key, certainly for me, is just reminding myself of that every day and looking at my wife and saying, she is the beauty that I'm fighting for. I'm the hero. I, you know, kind of almost like talk yourself up and remind yourself, hey man, yeah, we want to know that. We want to know that you're the man. You have what it takes. And every little boy kind of walks around with that fear and that kind of unanswered question. And, you know, am I a real boy? You know, do I have what it takes? And kind of there's an insecurity. There's, you know, the invalidation, you know, we don't know. And so we either then just walk around with that sort of brokenness of I don't know. It's, you know, it's not settled yet. I, you know, and then 40-year-old, 50-year-old guys, walking around kind of with an unanswered question. And so there's the turmoil inside. And so we've got to try and prove it, either toxic masculinity, you know, dominate, prove that I am a real man, you know, bigger, you know, bigger truck, tighter jeans, you know, whatever it is, and try to, you know, kind of prove. And if we don't have that, there is no peace. So I try to challenge myself every day with my wife and say, I am the man. And that brings me peace, but I can't just kind of say that. I've got to do it. I've got to prove it. And now I don't get to go and slay the dragon. I don't get to beat up guys in the street to defend her honor. But what can I do? Man, I can get up while it's still dark and I can go and make her some coffee. I can, you know, I can offer my strength. And so that for me is that I'm constantly looking for ways to offer my strength, because that's the definition that we give these young men. You are a man as soon as you can offer your strength on behalf of another. And so that, just even saying it like that, that assumes that, hey, you have a strength to offer. And that's kind of empowering. What? I do? Like, yeah, oh, cool. Okay, that's great. What does that look like? Go and serve. And I love, you know, obviously kind of service, sacrifice, that kind of thing, and do hard things. Because I feel like that's where it's at, and that's what we can do every day.
That's awesome. I tell my boys about this kind of stuff, you know, all the time. When you sit out late night, like we were doing last night, watching the meteor shower, if you guys didn't see it, or if you don't stargaze with your kids, you're missing out, because it's a great time to talk about, you know, philosophy and all these lessons. But, you know, to kind of bring it back to what you're talking about, this idea that, you know, you get up, you're the first one up, you're the last one to sleep. And if you're not tired by the end of the day, you didn't do enough, and you didn't do enough for everybody else. Right. And that's, that is a, I think that critical key is the selflessness that I think that you embody, right. As the dad, as the protector, as the husband, to be as selfless as possible and to put everybody else first with a thankful heart. Yeah, absolutely, man. That is such a huge thing that I think is missing. You know, you could probably tie it back to the food supply and the malnutrition and everything else, where people are living in a bit of a fog and are not only not nourished in their diet, but not nourished in their soul. That is, you know, this purposeful living where you are conscious, you are present, and you are doing a service for somebody else is absolutely, I've found, the greatest path to not only fulfillment but enlightenment in this you know, right, meat suit that we wear around.
Absolutely, nothing to hide, nothing to fear, nothing to prove. Yeah. And if we can be those guys, just do that and fight for the hearts of those around us, man, that's real living. And so I think there's a unique role that fathers play in terms of bestowing identity on their young men and giving them that peace, answering their question by inviting them up into the story and kind of saying, hey man, you have what it takes. You are a man. Do hard things. Because I think as you do hard things, so like these camps, you know, where you are tested, I mean, physically, emotionally, socially, you know, kind of 100 kids, it's tough. But basically what these kids come up with through that experience, it's a kind of a rite of passage. And once you've done that, you don't have to prove anything because you know, wow, I did that. This camp literally, I mean, finished on Thursday. We did over 500 burpees. I think it was 1900 jump squats, 1200 push-ups in 3 days, and sleeping on the ground in the bush, carrying poles around, you know, in your group, having rolling in the mud every morning. I mean, it's winter in Zimbabwe right now, so it's cold. I mean, I was in the mud with the guys because I tell them, like, hey, you know, you can't make other people do or expect other people do what you're not prepared to do yourself. So yeah, let's go, guys. I'm, you know, in the, and it was bitter, brutal. I mean, it's, you know, and I say, guys, why are we doing this? You know, don't do something that you don't understand the purpose of it. Why are we doing this? And basically I just keep repeating that till the end of the week when they realize, like, hey, because it doesn't matter how fit you are, the mud is the great equalizer. We're all as miserable as each other. And if you can do that, you know, willfully, purposefully, go and put yourself through that, you can do anything. Because the day when you have the dark night of the soul and you are at your lowest point, you'll remember this and think back to this and say, hey, I could do that. I could do this. And then it gives you kind of the ability to go forward. I want to show you a quick, I know this is not the most efficient way of doing this, but this is the final morning. So, okay, we've done this, you know, so 3 days, this is the fourth morning. We do this beast of a physical. So I take these guys down to this lake on the camp. And we do a physical. I mean, it's brutal. Burpees, push-ups, jump squats, until the sun rises. And it's, you know, it's 5:30 in the morning. Sun rises at 6:30, and so these kids are just like, "Oh, you got to be kidding me!" And I was like, "Guys, we're not stopping until we see the sun." And there's this bank of clouds that you can start to see. It starts to get light. They're like, "Oh, the sun is never gonna show." And we just go. And it's like, "Guys, you can do this. Come on, prove it to yourself. Find out. Let's find out." You know, and we just go for it. And eventually the sun rises, the bagpipes start playing, and we pop green smoke. So I've got a video of this is Thursday morning last week in Zimbabwe with 100 boys.
That's awesome.
Yeah, wow.
Cool. Love the bagpipes.
That's
too.
Cool as hell.
yeah. It's good fun.
Man, I got chills listening right? to you describe that.
Yeah. Do I was talking about farming the whole time. And now I'm like, oh man, I'm having flashbacks into like reconnaissance training and indoctrination and all that fun stuff, man. where you're literally carrying logs around doing log PT, you're wet and sandy and miserable with everybody, and you're just like, man. At least I'm not last, I guess. I don't know. Like,
and so, you know, so I went through that as a 17-year-old. But a lot of kind of the stuff that we've brought into it now is inspired by some of the vets that I'm friends with now. You know, guys like Matt, guys like Jeff in Texas. So it's been good. It's been a good alliance.
Kudos to you as a 44-year-old getting out there and doing that with them too. And I say that because it's one of those things where, yeah, it's one thing for those guys to know that you've done it and can't, you know, and could do it again. But it's another thing for those guys to actually go through it with you, and you go through it with them as well, because there is you're both miserable, you're wet, you're looking at each other. This guy's 44 years old. He's looking at, he's got four kids and a wife, and you know he's still out here in the morning, and he cares enough about us to come out here and show us a better way to live our lives, kind of a shortcut or, you know, the cheat codes to life in a lot of ways. And that's extremely admirable.
So the 2 years ago when Matt was with me on this, on that 17-year-old camp, it was like zero. It was miserable. And I kind of said to the other staff, I was like, guys, I'm not comfortable. Just one particular day, I was like, I'm not actually comfortable sending these guys through this. I mean, this is torture. I mean, this is brutal. I'm not feeling really warm and fuzzy about this. And Matt, whose house I'm at right now, he said, yeah, that's fine. You know, that's fine. You can give them a pass. You can tell them they don't have to do that. And that's, you know, you can do that, but they will always know that they were the one group that didn't do it. And it's like, oh man. Get in the mud, go, go, go.
So yeah, so good.
Damn.
Speaking of all this like masculinity and kind of getting into, it's really kind of like getting at the core of like sovereignty and freedom, right? Like being able, like, as a man, knowing that you can like push through and deal with just about any adversity you can get into, especially like showing like young men that before they get to the point of actually competing with full-fledged men.
Right.
It's got me thinking about to like the stories that you have told us about the Zimbabwe people and like the nationalization of the farming and the hyperinflation that we talked about in the pre-show kind of like hangout. I've been curious. So are the Zimbabwe people, are they well educated on like what happened in Russia with like the communist revolution and like the collapse of the Weimar Republic? Cause it seems like you guys got both of those lessons at relatively the same time. Does everybody have that top of mind?
So no, I don't think anyone, I mean, I'm not aware of that. I don't think anyone is really, well-versed in that sort of thing or knows about that. But our reality is that we've had a government that kind of took advantage of us. And I mean, you know, Mugabe was apparently, you know, a billionaire, was a really wealthy guy from this tiny little impoverished country. How does that happen? You know, well, so basically what they were doing was the political elites were just printing money because they could, and no one kind of knew what was happening. No one could stop them. And so I remember as a teenager, the rate, you know, so Zim dollars to US dollars was about 20 to 1 when I was in high school. And so when I was, you know, writing my SATs and looking at coming to school over here, man, that was a big deal for my parents. Like, wow, man, 20 to 1. Ooh, eesh, this is expensive. This is going to be hard. You know, you better get a scholarship. We're not going to be able to pay for the whole thing. And, you know, anyway, so that's cool. You know, did that. I remember then coming back. So sort of the first summer, going home for summer break, and the rate was 1500 to 1. in cool. 1500 to 1. So it's like, wow, this is crazy. And then it just carried on. So that's early 2000s. I then remember coming back when I then moved back to Zim. So this is around 2006. There's just abject poverty now and everybody just got cleaned out. You know, the money's worthless. And I had parked somewhere outside a store and I came outside. I was new kind of back in Zim and kind of wasn't aware of, you know, and a guy kind of was cleaning my window, my car window, as I got to the car. And he's like, oh, sir, I've cleaned your window. You're going to help me. You know, do you have some money for me? I was like, I didn't ask you to clean my window. But, you know, it was just a kind of a manipulative way of begging. But I was like, oh, okay. Here, you know, I pulled out some change and I gave him $500,000 bill. And he took it and he scrumpled it up and he threw it back at me. I was like, what? You know, and I knew, look, I knew it wasn't worth much, but you know, his response was just, wow. Anyway, they kept the printers running and I bought some of these old notes. I mean, I say old, but this is 2000. And, okay. So this is a 2008. That's pretty cool.
Wow, that's a lot of zeros.
It's a lot of zeros.
$1 million.
Yeah. So this was official currency in Zimbabwe. This would at that stage probably buy you a loaf of bread. Okay.
And loaf of bread for $1 million.
Yeah. So hyperinflation, people don't understand what hyperinflation is. So it's basically the people with the printer. Just printing money. I mean, this has got codes. It's got, you know, it's got kind of strips on it. It's legit. Like, you know, it's got a watermark. It's, you know, this is legitimate currency that the guys that were in power just said, oh, we need money. Just print more. And because it was so worthless, so it was 1 million to 1, and then it was, you know, 10 million to one. Then it was, you know, and it just kept going. And so people don't realize that prices in the store were doubling every 24 hours. So today it's $1 million. Tomorrow, same loaf of bread is 2 million. The next day, same loaf of bread is 4 million, 8 million. Just, you know, imagine. So I was getting paid in Zim dollars and I would just take my briefcase full of cash, then my backpack full of cash. Then I didn't have enough kind of space. I would, you know, shopping bags full of bricks of cash to go to the store or, you know, walk home. I paid for our honeymoon by taking bricks. So a brick is like, you know, 1,000 notes of this, you know, bundled together, go to this hotel where we ended up having our honeymoon. And I would empty my shopping bags onto this guy's desk and he would put it through the money counter and say, okay, that is, you know, $2.8 billion. Today's rate is okay, that's $18. And he would credit $18 to my account. And I did that for 3 months to be able to pay for our 5-day honeymoon in their hotel.
That is incredible. Can I ask you to pause for 1 second? Let me ask the audience to pay attention for 1 second to this, what's happening here. Like everybody who's hearing this right now live, we've got almost 600 people live and many more people are going to watch it afterwards. This is what happens in the end stages of a fiat currency.
Yeah.
You know, they tricked the United States of America by creating the Federal Reserve in 1913. The end result is all of the wealth is transferred from the population to a small number of people.
Yeah.
And they fooled us into doing that. Guys, pay deep attention to what's going on right now. There is one way out of this at the moment. It's that big B right there behind Shane. So that's all I'll say about that for right now. But I mean, this is the direction the United States of America is headed. It took 212 years for us to print the first $1 trillion of debt. We're at 35 trillion now and doing another trillion every 100 days.
Wake it's up. Actually even less than that now. We're talking about almost $1 trillion a month now. And that is, God, I don't know how fast hyperinflation, you know, comes along, but we got to be, I mean, I don't know. What is the actual definition of hyperinflation? Because we've got to be getting very, very close to it.
So the actual definition is 1,000% inflation.
Okay.
Yeah,
which would be a 10x in just straight numerical value, right? Or a 9x, technically.
Yeah. So that's the thing is think about this. I love kind of talking about this. Look at this piece of paper. Okay, so you know, currency, right? So when this came out, a roll of toilet paper was maybe 50 grand, and so this was a lot of money for a little while, and then after a month or two, toilet paper was $1 million. And so the same piece of paper was, you know, could buy you a roll of toilet paper. And then after another couple of days, maybe a month later, you know, we were up to this kind of thing.
$100 billion.
What? $100 billion?
Right. So by this stage,
BlackRock dollar,
you got any change for $100 billion?
So by the time that currency was in circulation, it would make more sense rather than spending money buying the toilet paper. It made more sense to just use the smaller denominations.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
For toilet paper. That's what fiat currency is. And so crazy. It was just a crazy experience to live through. So actually when we got married in 2009, my wife was a quadrillionaire. And so that's I don't want to marry a millionaire or a billionaire. I want to marry a quadrillionaire. She her last paycheck as a teacher, she was a second grade teacher, was $3 quadrillion. And so she saved the check, you know, as they paid it into her bank account. We went out of the country to get married so that my parents could attend. They were still persona non grata with the government. And so we got married in South Africa and then we go back to Zim. And go to her bank account now. This is our bank account now, you know, shared account. So let's go get our, you know, $1 quadrillion. And so, but then what happened during that time is that the government then dollarized conveniently. Okay, this is unmanageable. You know, this is, you know, 100 trillion. Well, they've ended up getting to trillions. So they printed $1 trillion bills, but I was out of the country for that time. So I don't have the $1 trillion bills. I've only got the billions. But they finally decided that it was unmanageable, and they couldn't fit the zeros on the $1 quadrillion bill. So they ended up scrapping the currency. We finally give up, and we dollarize. And so they open up and they scrap the Zim dollar, dissolve the currency, and we officially converted to a US dollar based economy. So all of your bank balances and everything like that overnight was instantly just converted just because, hey, we've changed our policy now. And so this is now, and they decided the rate. And so the rate was 3 quadrillion to 1. And so my wife's $3 quadrillion for a month of being a second grade teacher was $3 US in her bank account. Just like that.
Oh, wow.
So savings, lifetime savings wiped out for my parents, my wife's parents, everybody else in that generation that had worked their entire lives and faithfully paid their retirement scheme and done all that kind of stuff and been good and worked in the same job for 50 years and faithfully saved and put away and, you know, paid their retirement schemes.
$3.
Zero, basically wiped out.
So this is something I wanted to take the conversation to too, is like, particularly for Americans thinking like, oh, like, cause like you hear all these talking heads on MSNBC, CNBC, any of the mainstream media, just like parroting just megaphones, like, oh, we don't have issues with like the dollar system, like getting like weakened or done away with, cause there's like so many people use it and want dollars and all that.
Yeah.
But like Americans need to understand, especially if you haven't read like the Confessions of an Economic Hitman book, is that like a lot of the countries like Zimbabwe or Venezuela recently, I believe it was Argentina where Malay was, they just recently dollarized, right? A lot of these countries get used as overflow buckets for the liquidity of the global US dollar system. And a lot of that is because of the shadow banking system that's in the European central banking like cartel, because like we, like the US has no control or jurisdiction over how many dollars get printed into existence over there, on top of the dollars that we're already overprinting within our actual like system that's underneath regulatory confines, right? So like, as we just saw the petrodollar agreement fall apart with Saudi Arabia, and as these other countries start to like get away from like the dollar system, that liquidity has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't just like sit and die. It's going to get converted somewhere else, and or it's going to flood back into the U.S. and feed the inflation even more through currency debasement.
Right. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. There's a big game that's being played out there, and it's happening, and it's serving a few, and everybody else is paying the price. And so we've seen that. And so, you know, like I said, we've seen the puppet strings, So to talk about Bitcoin in Zimbabwe is a no-brainer. I mean, people are just like, you know, anything that's based on trust, we're not in, you know, we're not interested. And so even now that we've got the US dollar there, banks, you know, it's just a classic sort of a thing. No one keeps their money in the bank because we don't trust the banks, because government has control over them and they can just garnish your funds anytime. And so one of the biggest things that's kind of grown up around there is these safety deposit boxes. So there's like houses in the neighborhood now, in, you know, really top sort of neighborhoods that are converting into cash box facilities. And you'll walk into just a house in a neighborhood that's now being converted into one of these with just maximum security everywhere and cameras and fences and, you know, all this incredible kind of tech security with biometrics and everything. And you go in there, and there's just box after box after box in these kind of safe rooms with these little, you know, personalized rooms that you can go in and, you know, close the curtain and look at your money and count your money and whatever. And there's billions of dollars in those safety deposit boxes. So Zimbabwe has become the world's laundromat, basically, for dirty money, gold money, all kinds of stuff. That's just been brought in. It is. It's crazy.
Hmm.
Absolutely crazy.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
What do you tell me what you know about Bitcoin, Matthew?
So Matt, my friend here, a couple of years ago, he just said, "Hey, do you have any Bitcoin?" I said, "I've kind of heard about it, but you know, not really. I don't have any money. I mean, I'm a peasant farmer. I live in rural Africa. You know, I'm not a tech guy. I'm not into any of that kind of stuff." And he's like, "Okay, I'm going to give you some of this stuff. You just need to hold on to it. And just have it. You don't worry about it. I'm just going to set you up a wallet and I'm going to send you the stuff and just look at it every now and then, but don't worry about it. Just hold on to it." I said, "Yeah, cool. Sure. Okay." And so he did. And then he called me about a couple of months later and just said, "Hey, remember that Bitcoin thing I was telling you about? You know, just open your wallet and just go and have a look at how much is there now." And so I did that. And I was like, wow, hey, that's incredible. That's wow. That's so cool. How do I get some more of that? And he said, yeah, cool. And he, you know, basically helped me to try and do that. So the small little bit of savings that I did have, he said, right, I can help you, you know, to do that. And, sort of got in like that, and have been involved sort of since then, really just kind of trying to grow it and use it as a store of value. And then in Zim kind of started, once I started talking about it and was aware of it myself and was kind of involved and really understood, you know, he gave me a book as well. I think the first kind of book on kind of Bitcoin so that I understood, you know, what was happening. And I started speaking to some of the people at work. So, I mean, like junior sort of level folk at work, and then found out that they were all kind of using Bitcoin. And I was like, wow, are you kidding me? Like, you guys, that's incredible, you know? And then, so yeah, I started buying from them. So, and they were all sort of seeing this. And when I'm saying junior level people, I'm talking about people that earn $400 a month, you know, right. Guys. And they were saying, hey, I pay $60 in rent, $40 a month in school fees, and anything excess, I buy Bitcoin. So, you know, if it's working for them at that level, I thought, man, I've got to get involved. I've got to be more proactive with this. And so I have been, and it's been good.
Is this something you will talk about and teach at some of your camps with the young men?
So interestingly enough, I love to talk to these young men. And so I said, hey, what are you guys going to do when you leave school? You know, go one more year of school and then what? A lot of them are going to university in foreign countries. A lot actually go to the UK because of the ties, you know, former British colony. So lots of people go there. The Netherlands, actually quite a lot of Zimbabweans go to the Netherlands, obviously a lot to South Africa, some to the US, some to Australia. And I'm always asking them, hey guys, you know, and then what? What's the plan, right? What are you going to study? What are you going to do? And I obviously, as an ag guy now, I'm sort of tracking how many farmers there are, and basically zero. The number that want to be farmers is zero. Mm. And the average age of farmers in the country, well, in Africa at the moment, is 61. So, I mean, writing's on the
not
wall.
Not good math there.
Not good, right? I love talking to these guys. And this one year group, so this is about 2 years ago, these two young guys, phenomenal guys. I mean, just of the 15 years that I've been running these camps, doing this stuff, just two guys that just absolute sort of standouts. And I just, these kids, you know, and I sort of said to them, hey, you know, what are you guys going to do? How do I kind of, you know, how do I back you guys? Or, you know, how can I serve you? And you tell me what's important or where the world is going. And I want to listen to you guys. You guys teach me, kind of thing. So one is actually at Harvard now. And the other one is at university in Cape Town. Amazing young guys, smart guys. Hardworking, driven, you know, and I asked them what they are kind of into, what they are seeing, and of course they say Bitcoin. And so they both sort of said, yeah, every birthday they ask for, you know, birthday money instead of presents, and they just, you know, get Bitcoin and that kind of thing. And they said, yeah, that's kind of was their plan. It's what they were doing. They were getting involved in Bitcoin. And that also kind of just reinforced for me. And I said, yeah, if you guys, you know, if you 18-year-olds are seeing that and understand that and saying this is the future, I'm in.
That's super exciting.
Mm.
I can see a pathway because of Bitcoin to more farming. You want to hear it?
Yes, please.
So if you think about the behavioral incentives in a fiat monetary system, because fiat, they're constantly making more of it, the purchasing power of it's going down. So the effect on humanity is that we run on this hamster wheel chasing fiat dollars faster and faster and faster all the time, chasing because prices are constantly moving away from us, right? So that's the effect. We're spending the money as fast as we get it.
Yeah.
And it encourages at scale, mass economically, businesses like Walmart, where the components of the things that you're buying are basically as cheap as humanly possible, right? Like it's like it's this entire economy of consumerism. It's garbage stuff that you're buying, so it gets worn out, you have to buy more, and it's this constant rat race of continuous consumption, right? So a lot of people are like, well, you know, Bitcoin isn't money because you don't use it as a medium of exchange. But the thing is that you'll never use it as a medium of exchange if you own it until the opportunity cost of its value has been arbed away in your mind. So there's stages that people, that money goes through. There's this really good book. It's this one right here. It's called The Bullish Case for Bitcoin by BJ Boyapati. Highly recommended read. One of the things he talks about there is it starts out as a collectible, then it becomes a store of value before it will ever become a medium of exchange and eventually a unit of account, meaning things are priced in it, right? So currently it's in the store of value stage and will continue to be in the store of value stage until it accumulates enough economic gravity, mass, so to speak, or dollars or whatever, investment, to where that condition is arbed away in people's mind. If you talk to any Bitcoiner, there's probably some price at which that Bitcoiner might be willing to give up some of their Bitcoin for a change in lifestyle in some way or another, right? But that number might be really high, which means they're never going to transact with it until then. So what is the behavioral incentive of owning a form of money that goes up in value and goes up in purchasing power instead of going down in purchasing power? The behavioral result of that is you don't want to part with your Bitcoin unless you're getting the very best of whatever it is you're buying, whether that's a table that Shane makes or soap that Mike's makes or, you know, some kind of agricultural product that Matthew's making, right? But the point is that, like, when that is true, there is room for small-scale producers who are producing things of great quality. If I don't want to part with my Bitcoin, but I want to buy food that tastes the best, looks the best, has the highest nutritional content. And oh, by the way, the farmer down the street, my buddy Matt, is producing this stuff. And maybe in dollar terms, it's 20 or even 50% more expensive, but I have the superior money and I'm willing to do that. That's how it becomes that way. That's how the entire economy of consumption flips upside down, is changing the money.
I love it. I love
Case in point, yeah. Man. Casey Cattle Company, right? Is like, you got that hard-earned Bitcoin, but you'll trade it for some amazing beef that's, you know, that's, you know, raised and processed by some veterans here in the United States, because it's worth it. And to support those guys, it's worth it. And boy, great insight, Alex.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that. Great explanation. Yeah, and that's like Matt. You know, there's other Matt here. That's kind of how I feel. I feel so grateful to him, so thankful, because he's sort of saying, hey, yeah, I see what you guys are doing in terms of regen and sustainable farming and transforming lives. And so he's kind of saying, hey, yeah, that's his hard-earned Bitcoin. Like he's able to invest in us and able to help us do that. So very special.
Speaking of that real quick, Doc, I had forgotten to ask you a particular question, because you're doing kind of like a tour across the U.S. for the next couple of months, right? And you being in the regen agriculture space, and because of the, like I had told you about, I've done some writing and some research into the whole kind of area. Are you, do you have intentions of like linking up or working with like Gabe Brown or David Montgomery? They've been doing a lot of work out of South Dakota. I was curious to know if you were planning on swinging through there and working with them at all.
Yeah, brilliant. So obviously know who those guys are. They are legends kind of in the space. So no plans to kind of link up with them. No sort of plan. I was at the World Congress on Conservation Agriculture recently, and obviously everyone kind of spoke about them as well. But yeah, unfortunately not going to get to see them this time. Yeah. So my sort of mentor guy, Brian Aldreeve, so he's considered the pioneer or the father of conservation agriculture in Southern Africa. And so he started doing that in 1978, which was kind of, there was a bad sort of drought year. So the last time we had a drought like this, 1978, and bad sort of time in our country, end of the war, all that kind of thing. And he started trying to just come out of it. He was just watching where he was seeing his crops just not surviving. He knew that he was losing topsoil to wind erosion and sheet water erosion, whatever, and just said, this is not a sustainable system. There's got to be another way. So he actually started studying the dust bowls of Texas from the 1930s. And that's where he saw the no-till, and he started just applying that and practicing that and slowly developed this system. And then, of course, as we said earlier, Alan Savory, another Zimbabwean guy, so who developed the whole regen thing, and you know, the strip grazing and the mob grazing and the more cows on instead of less, and just incredible that they're both Zimbabwean guys. And so I feel, having had the privilege to see and to journey and be there with both of those kind of iconic kind of founders, it's been a really cool privilege. But I know that there are these other guys all over, and especially here in the US.
Man, it's incredible. We're developing this network of citadels. We call it the Citadel Network here in the United States, amongst Bitcoin veterans, where citadels, quite briefly, are parcels of land that guys either already own or they're intending to buy, with the idea of resilience, and homesteading and self-sustainability. So I think that many of them would be very interested in this stuff. After this podcast, we definitely need to keep in touch. Because sure. I think you have a lot to add here. Awesome. Let's really quick. We're here 10 minutes after the hour. Let's hit some, our last two sponsors, do our shout outs here. And then we can do the famous part of the show. So want to shout out Solo Satoshi. These guys can be found at solosatoshi.com. You guys can do your part, all of you, in supporting the decentralization of the Bitcoin network by supporting these guys. Go there, buy a bit axe, buy 5 bit axes. Be like Steve. Steve, I think, has bought 20 bit axes at this point. You guys know who I'm talking about. This guy is a monster. But anyway, all these things, the whole idea here is if any country were to go, you know, let's say, for example, the United States of America said, you can no longer do Bitcoin mining in the US. Well, guess what? If there's 1 million people or 10 million people or 50 million people all running one of these tiny little things that that use less than $5 electricity every single month, you're decentralizing the entire mining of the network, and you're increasing the resilience and the robustness of the network. So go check them out, solosatoshi.com. They're also at solosatoshi on Twitter. Our next sponsor that we want to shout out real quick is Punch Plates. Go to punchplate.com and go check these out. These are what we call metal seed plates. This is how you back up your seed phrase. For those of you who know what that is, basically when you have a Bitcoin wallet and you have a seed phrase, you can use this to back up your words, whether those are your 12 or 24 words, and put that in a nice, safe place. And that way, you know, it's protected versus getting wet or catching on fire or all the things. And you can, of course, use that to restore your Bitcoin in the event of a strange boating accident or any other thing happening to your access to that Bitcoin temporarily. Punchplates.com.
They're a fraction of, what is that, 24 bucks for a 24-word punch plate? Like, what, 75, yeah. 100 bucks for a lot of those things out there? Yeah,
they're really good. Once I found those guys, by the way, I personally used them. I personally used them before they came on as a sponsor. They're just the baddest, coolest little thing, because it's like a cipher. If you don't know what you're looking at, you have no idea what it is. It's just a bunch of dots on a metal plate. Very cool.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, what everybody comes to this show for.
Who said that? Who the fuck said that? What have we got here? A fucking comedian, private joker.
It's story time, ladies and gents. thanks for actually reading the prompt for coming on the show. You are one of two people, I think, who actually read. Yep. And have been apprised of story time. We kind of touched on this a little bit before the show, and I'm really excited for you to share the story with everybody, because it is it's a very endearing story, and I think it provides just a ton of hope. And you know, for those people that need white pills out there, let this be one of those for you.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. So yeah, I love story time, and kind of you know, I feel like there's some stories, you know, especially kind of being a rugby guy, you know, the sort of the stories, the stuff that we did in college. Oftentimes I just kind of feel like I can't tell some of the stories, because people are like there's no way that happened. Like, they just don't believe you. You know, like, it's like, So I'll kind of give some context with arriving in Texas and having been a Zimbabwean, you know, rugby guy and everything. And so I was high school rugby captain and Zim school's rugby and water polo. And so I came across to the States and found the rugby guys. You know, first week on campus, I'm like, find the rugby guys, and, you know, safe space, cool, familiar kind of guys. And I go to the rugby house the first sort of Friday night for the first party of the semester, first party in America, you know, and I don't know anybody. And I'm this sweet, gentle little guy from Africa and I talk funny and, you know, and so I'm, you know, kind of going there and I'm, you know, wide eyed. I'm 19. So I can't drink, although, you know, in Zimbabwe, I've been drinking since I could, you know, look over the bar counter and I'm timid. I'm afraid. I don't know how to, you know, so walk around and the guy's like running through the house, like screaming and like drinking and there's girls and, you know, and so the first guy says, "Hey man, you want a beer?" And I was like, "Well, am I allowed?" You know, kind of thing. And he's like, "Yeah, go in the garage." So I go to the garage, and there's a guy standing there. So his name, I won't share his real name because he's a pastor now, actually in Houston. But 6'3", 260, and I mean, big dude, red hair, long curly red hair, big red chest, and I mean, he's naked. And he's standing there by the keg, naked, and he's like, "What are you drinking? What are you drinking?" And I was like, "Oh, a beer, please, sir." You know, and he's like pouring this thing. He's like, "Quick, I don't got a lot of time." And I like look, and there's some toilet paper like stuck in his butt, like it's coming out, like trailing across the garage, and it's on fire. So that's my introduction to the rugby guys, and I just said, okay, this is it. These are my guys. These are my people. And so that kind of carried on very much like that. You know, similar kind of setup for the next 4 years, and I became the rugby captain of the university and Texas Collegiate All-Star Rugby team, and just having a ball. You know. I'm at all the right parties. I'm dating all the right girls, become homecoming king, dating the homecoming queen, you know, just living the dream. And then senior year, 3 weeks before graduation, we're at a party and a guy, one of the rookies, kind of shows up on a brand new cross rocket and he's like in the front yard just revving and he's like, "Woo!" And so I go down, jump on the back. I'm like, "Hey, let's go, you know, take me for a spin." So he goes up, we go down onto the highway, opens up 100 miles an hour. And so I've just stepped out of the party. I'm not wearing any leathers. I've got no helmet. I'm just in, you know, jump on the back of the and go. And he loses it at 100 miles an hour, flicks both of us over the handlebars. I came down head first. I don't think you can see here, but I've got this scar here. So over the handlebars, land head first, roll onto my back, skid on my back for 100 meters. The ambulance comes and it pronounces me dead on arrival. They take me to the hospital. I'm in a coma for 5 days, lie on my stomach for the next 5 months, and 9 months in a wheelchair, just carnage, you know, complete carnage, end of my story, kind of end of rugby, end of the big parties, end of all that stuff that I thought was I was winning the game of life. I thought, you know, babes, brawn, you know, bucks and brains, you know, I kind of was trying to, my scoreboard was ticking over, you know, I thought that was the scoreboard on life. If you can be the rugby captain and be on an academic scholarship and be dating the homecoming queen and her dad's a millionaire, like, you know, hey, you know, you are winning and your scoreboard is, you know, is live. And so once I had the accident and now could no longer play rugby, was no longer, you know, the guy to be at all the right parties, and ended up, you know, breaking up with that girl and that kind of thing. And I just thought my life was over, that I was losing the game of life. And so deep depression, 9 months in a wheelchair, kind of, you know, I'm done. And had this random kind of conversation with this guy that I sort of, it was a complete just mystery how we ended up kind of connecting. But speak to this guy and he says, "If I gave you $1 million to start a company doing whatever you want to do, you got to use all the money in the business. What do you do?" And I was like, I'm back in Zimbabwe. I'm running adventure-based leadership camps for young men, inspiring young men to take a leadership role in their own lives, you know, something like that. He says, "What are you waiting for? You'll never be alive until you're doing that. That's what you're born to do. Mm. I'm not going to give you the money, but that's what you need to do with your life." So 3 months after that conversation, I land back in Zimbabwe in the middle of hyperinflation. I'm like, "Oh my goodness, bad idea." That was the dumbest idea I ever had. That was bad. What, are you kidding me? $1 million and I can't even, what? Okay, this is not going to last long. You know, I've been a bad boy. Let me clean my slate. Let me stop drinking, get off drugs, you know, clean up my act, whatever. 6 months, you know, I'll do this for 6 months, you know, in the fastest shrinking economy on the planet, working with orphans in the village. Oh man, it's miserable. Okay, 6 months and then I will have cleaned my slate and I'll go back to America, finish my MBA, you know, get on with my real life, and live the American dream. And that's what life's all about. But once I started running those camps and being out there in rural Africa and fighting for the hearts of these young men, I remember being surrounded by this group of 12-year-old kids, and we're on a camp and we're playing capture the flag or something. And I was like, come on, boys, come on, man, we're going to do it. And I was doing everything that I loved and missed about playing rugby, except I was trying to help these guys win. Not just a game on a Saturday afternoon with a little rugby ball. I was trying to help them win the game of life. Yeah. And I remember that kind of feeling of satisfaction, that deep feeling of purpose and meaning and life. And I just said, I can't imagine doing anything else with my life. I love this. And I will do this for as long as I can. And so here we are 16 years later and still going, still doing it, still loving it. Just more alive than I've ever been. You know, I tell these young guys now over there, man, when you find out what you were born to do, what you repeatedly do, what you do well, you don't need to be paid to do it. You don't need an alarm clock to wake up in the morning to get to go and do that. You just do it because that's who you are. And so I feel tremendously privileged to be able to do that and to be able to get to live that dream and to be friends with guys like I sense in this group, you know, you guys that I'm just chatting to now, guys like Matt, who believe in the important things in life, that will commit to the process of building young men, of building communities, of building citadels, and, you know, this kind of thing, and doing life together, living life on purpose instead of sitting on the sidelines, letting life happen to us. To actually overcome spectatoritis and get into the arena to be a community of hope and healing in this hurting world. It's a great privilege. And so I love what you guys stand for. I love who you guys are. And I feel really, really privileged to be in part of this. So thank you.
God, I'm fired up. I mean, it makes it very easy to get out of bed at those dark, you know, dark hours when this is what you get to do on a, you know, on a daily, weekly basis. I mean, unbelievable. Matt, I'm going to send it around the room. We've got, it's 8:21 here, coming into the final wrap. Mike, Alex, anything you guys want to wrap up with today?
All I will say, as if it's diminishing what I'm about to say, what I will echo is that I was expecting to just be talking about regenerative farming like this whole time. And I personally appreciated the hop to the Intel community and the relationship with what's going on with government and Intel and all that. And then talking about the financial stuff and the Bitcoin stuff, and the masculine stuff, dude. Like, this is probably my favorite surprise, kind of like, as far as like the conversation goes, to all the conversations we've had with the slew of people. So I appreciate you, Matt. Like, I'm looking forward to working with you in the future.
Amazing. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, for sure. And likewise, like, I just want to say, man, I feel honored. Really. This has been a great treat. Like, you know, you're one of our people. I can tell. I don't even know you, but I can, just from this conversation, you're one of us. And, you know, always looking for men of quality, always looking to be around guys who are just solid dudes that make you want to be a better man. That's amazing. What I'm always looking for. So
amazing.
Yeah. Looking forward to hanging out with you more, getting to know you better.
Absolutely. So I'm going to leave these here, with Matt. So these are a gift to you guys, just so you can show people what happens when you don't have Bitcoin.
Hyperinflated.
Awesome.
Yeah, I gotta echo a lot of what Mike said. I didn't know all of what we were going to get into. You know, come for the regenerative farming, stay for the wholesomeness and
it's a very based conversation we've had today.
Oh, it's so good though. And I think this is what this space needs more and more and more of. it's great. Yeah, I'm super happy that it's, you know, Bitcoin centric and that, you know, these things are being done and we're learning how to heal not only ourselves, but our land and our culture, but really getting down to that family unit and that relationship with a higher power and being, you know, very at peace and within balance within ourselves and with our environment, while making new leaders. Well, I mean, and having, you know, like you said earlier, you know, like God creates and things die and like eventually that's going to be us. And, you know, whatever's left is going to be our remnant that's left in this, this newer generation. And so for you to so eloquently come in here and tell those stories, you know, you can see that you just bleed into these guys and that passion has definitely infected us tonight. So, I mean, I hope you'll stick around for a few minutes after we close up because you're not far away. You know, if you have time, we'll talk about possibly me running over there or you guys running over here either way. But Matt, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you. Literally, like, I hope this is not the last time. I mean, I'm sure it won't be the last time in Bitcoin Veterans, but having a meetup where you're involved would be spectacular. So for everybody else out there, you guys, thank you guys for all making this stuff happen. You know, this is just one small part of Bitcoin Veterans. This is kind of the face sometimes. And there are so much happening behind the scenes. If you want to get involved, whether it's in comms, whether it's Citadels, whether it's, you know, mentorship, whether it's, you know, Operation Bitcoin, where we're doing Skillshare, whether it's Brave for PTSD, you name it. We've got something for you. We can plug you in. You can go to bitcoinveterans.org and you can sign up there. We'll get you plugged into the chat and then it's up to you, whatever you want to do. As long as you're peaceful, that's our main constraint here. This is a peaceful revolution that we're trying to push and create in parallel into the world that is chaos out there. Now it is the hope and that, you know, I think it's our responsibility as the remnant of the last generation that passed it to us to do this for everybody else. So thanks everybody again for being here on a Tuesday night. This is the new scheduled time, 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. We will be back next week. No guests next week, I think. Go ahead, Alex.
Be peaceful, not harmless.
Be peaceful, not harmless. Yeah, absolutely. And until then, we'll see you. Peace, not harmless.